Welcome, Capital Raisers. I love talking to fund syndication attorneys like Bethany LaFlamme. I always learn more with attorneys than I do with even the best capital raisers. So, are you guys ready to raise? Shout out to InvestNext, our investor portal of choice, and our great friends at the Family Office Club. Do not miss the Strategic Capital Raise Conference on June 7th and 8th, 2024. It's going to be fire with over 50 speakers and 1,000 registrants. Get your free tickets now at strategiccapitalraise.com. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show episode 305, and it starts now. Rock and roll, I got Bethany LaFlamme on the Capital Raiser Show. Welcome, my friend. How the heck are you?
I am so awesome. Thank you for having me.
This is going to be a blast. Thank you, by the way, for participating in our very first Raising Money Masterclass. Everybody loved that presentation and really excited to have you on the show. I've had Mauricio, your partner, on. For the audience that doesn't know you, Bethany, can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with syndication law?
I started practicing law now 23 years ago. I started off in litigation, didn't really love that, went into M&A. I did like that for a while. And then I did a lot of securities work on the venture side, startups, technology, aerospace, that kind of thing. And I got a little burned out, honestly. And I was leaving law. I left law. I went to try to start a fund. I failed miserably. And I was sort of licking my wounds. I met Mauricio, my partner, and he needed some help in running his thriving firm. It was booming. And I met him and he was like, I need some help. I said, great, I'll help you, but I'm out of law. I'll help you until I figure out what I'm going to do. I'll help you till you figure out what you're going to do, but I'm out. I don't want to do this anymore. And I hadn't been in real estate before. And so the first PPM that I did, I was like, what's this net cash flow? Who cares about net cash flow? Because I was working with startups. There's no net cash flow when you're buying a startup. I'm like, wait, there's cash flow. This is kind of a good gig. I like real estate. And then I started meeting the clients. And I met the clients and I got to be honest, like I fell in love. I'm like, wait, this awesome. Is really different than I worked at Big Law and I was working with the VCs and the Silicon Valley bros. And, you know, I was kind of treated like I was the help, honestly. And I'm entrepreneurial. I wanted to be in there. I wanted to be strategizing and I wanted to be like getting dirty with everybody. And this market, this real estate syndication market, it's real people trying to build an empire and trying to get out of their daily grind. And that's me. I can relate with. And so I stayed. Here I am 5 years later, running the firm.
That's so cool. I didn't know that about Mauricio, that you guys both were looking for something to do. Capital Raiser Show season 4, presented and powered by our friends at Family Office Club. And shout out to our new sponsor, InvestNext. Bethany, I want to dive into your fund that you launched. What was that for?
I failed at miserably. Yeah, way to bring up old stuff. No, I'm just kidding. I started this fund that was technically brilliant, legally sound, super complicated. And it was an EB-5 fund, which if you don't know, EB-5, it's a visa for foreign investors where they invest $500,000, create jobs, they get a visa to come into the US. So it was really, really booming back after 08. And I learned a lot about it. So I started this fund where we get EB-5 money and local money, domestic money, and we would do a real estate development in an area that needed it to create jobs and like a redevelopment. Mm-hmm. And we would house tech startup incubators or accelerators for women and minority-led businesses. Sounds nice, but like see your face, you're like, okay, that's a lot.
No, right? It's fascinating. Hey. So I do get curious when people mention charity or non-for-profit stuff that they are trying to raise capital for, because a lot of times people think altruistically it makes sense to help veterans or wives of veterans find homes. But at the end of the day, the investor still wants, in addition to having an impact, they also want to make money. And some of these nonprofits don't.
It wasn't a nonprofit. I'm just saying in general. Yeah, no, in general. You've got the people are all excited, women and minority led, whatever, but startups is a super risky endeavor. Mm. Real estate development in the real estate world, also a little riskier than what real estate people wanted. So now I'm on the riskiest end of both of these two worlds. And usually an investor at real estate and startup investors, they don't live in the same body. So now I've got the riskiest of both, asking them to do both at the same time. It was a failure to launch. It was a big learning experience for me. I mean, I learned a ton, but now I'm in this position where when people come to me, they're going to start a fund. I'm like, let's talk about that.
Yeah. Love that. Okay. So if you were to do it all over again, what do you think you would have changed? Or was it the hard part just the raising the capital of it? Is that why it failed, or was it something else?
Well, it was raising the capital of it, and it was a little bit of hubris, honestly. I thought, oh, I've seen hundreds of deals. I'm a lawyer. I'm a securities lawyer. Of course I can do this. People will invest with me, and people are like, have you done a real estate development before?
Mm.
Have you operated a startup before? The answer to both of those was a resounding no, I had not. So then I learned about building your team, OPE, other people's everything. You hear me talk about that all the time, is that I didn't need to do it all, and I absolutely should not be doing it all because it just wasn't my lane. So I learned that I need help, and I learned how to figure out what I'm amazing at and what I love to do and stick with that, like stick in my lane.
Yeah. So a lot of people think that they can just launch a fund and the money will be there automatically. And they get that question quite a bit. In fact, when I was thinking about launching my own funds, one of my partners mentioned, hey, instead of starting your own fund, why don't you just partner with me? I've already got funds. I've already done this. People are going to ask you, how many of these have you done before? And if the answer is zero, it's going to be a little bit of an uphill battle. I mean, you can kind of mitigate that a little bit by saying, hey, I'm working with this amazing operator and leverage their track record. But you do have to be able to handle that question. How many of these funds have you done before?
Yeah. And if you say none, that might be okay. The two questions, one you just brought up, which is, okay, but who are you partnering with then? Let's see what you've got. And then what are you bringing to the table? And you've got to be ready to answer that question. Like, what value do you bring? As a securities lawyer, I'm going to tell you the value can't just be, well, I raise money. There's got to be something more. That's why I always tell people, like, when you figure out your lane, if it's capital raising, that's fine. But that's a wider lane than a lot of people think it is. There's diligence that happens. There's underwriting that happens. There's more into it than I'm just going to beg for money.
Yes. All right. So let's actually talk about this, because people think that raising capital is just asking people for money and it's there. They don't account for the money, the time, the energy, the platforms that you build, the webinars that you're creating, the work in bringing all those people together. Raising capital isn't just like, boom, the money's there and then you walk away. A lot of times there's all this other stuff that you have to do just to even begin to get people to know and like and trust you, which a lot of times comes to exposure. Can you tell us about, because you can't just raise capital and walk away. You have to be a part of the operations of a business, and that can mean administration or underwriting, like you mentioned, or any number of other things, investor relations, or if you own your own fund, managing your own fund, all of that stuff, paying for it. Tell us about, like, what can people legally do to stay involved with it that doesn't include, like, you swinging hammers or like managing property managers.
Fixing toilets. Yeah. As you probably know, but maybe your listeners don't, is what the requirement is that you've got to have to be part of the GP team and legitimately be raising money as part of the issuer manager. You've got to have substantial duties. Okay. Well, what is substantial duties? That's the question that you're asking me. So one thing we can say is it's not just raising the money, taking a fee and walking away. We know that. That seems pretty obvious. The other thing though, is we've gotten some indication from the SEC through no action letters, which is basically like the SEC giving its opinion on something that's not really at issue right now. It's just like them opining about something like, here's what I think would happen if someone brought this case. And what they said was they didn't think that simply investor relations was going to be enough to rise to the level of substantial duties to keep you out of trouble by getting compensated for raising money. So as you may know, the main way to get compensated to raise money, of course, is you have to be a registered broker dealer with FINRA. Most people in this business, they're not actually that. Another way, though, is that you're part of a deal. You're actually a partner on a deal. You're allowed to raise money for your own deals. That's what we call the issuer exemption. So long way to answer your question is there are a lot of different things you can do. And by the way, just doing the webinars or building relationships, that's not even really enough because that's still part of the capital raise. So your job is big as a capital raiser because not only do you have to do all those things, make people know, like, and trust you, do the webinars, build the pipeline, you know, all the things, you also have to be working in the company. So you could be doing investor relations, okay, fine. But when I say investor relations, I don't mean calling all your investors to make sure they're not upset you brought them into this deal. I mean, you're generating reports, you're making sure K-1s get out on time, setting up the portal, you're doing, working with the lawyers, for example, to get the PPM done, which is, I recognize, a big job. But beyond that, you should really be doing diligence on the property. What are you telling these people they should invest in? Is it your company? If it is, then you ought to stand behind this property. You ought to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
How much is it making? Maybe you don't have to do the underwriting, but you should sure understand it.
Are there any duties that you can do up front and then not have to do too much along the way? For example, like underwriting the deal or finding and bringing the deal, like putting it under contract and then pretty much you've completed your duty, or do you have to do something ongoing in order to stay compliant?
Not everybody's an asset manager, but you should be involved though and know what's going on in the operation of the business itself. So are you going to be the one there swinging hammers? No, but you should be showing up to the management meetings and you should have a say in the major decisions of this company because it's your company. So maybe you're not the one deciding by yourself, does this property manager stay or go, because that's not your area, but you should be involved in the overall direction of this. Gosh, we might have to pivot a little bit. The market's changing. Are we going to sell? Are we going to refi? Are we still on track for our business plan? You should be involved in all those because you knew the plan up front because you were involved in the diligence and the making of this plan. So yes, you should stay involved after the fact. No, that does not mean you are on the property doing asset management. Not everybody is an asset manager.
Okay, cool. Speaking of compliance, I want to chat a little bit about something that I see a lot of violations in this kind of particular space, which is the joint venture, smaller, anywhere from like, I don't know, 70, four to, I guess, anywhere from a duplex to a 70 unit, where people are putting their own money into it. And maybe there's some family members or some other partners that don't necessarily do a lot. And I think in some cases, they're even completely passive. And that is a violation of securities law. So Is it enough if somebody that provides money to the investor, owner, operator, if they provide the money and then they're making decisions like when you sell it, what kind of appliances are put in there, but they're not really in there doing much, at what point is it a violation of securities law to bring in one of these investors?
So there are a couple of things. You want to make sure, first of all, that doesn't look like a syndication, right? You've got more than, let's say, five people involved and most of them are acting kind of passive. That's going to start to look like a syndication. So you want to, the number of people involved is going to be a factor. The bad news is the SEC hasn't said if it's more than five, then it's a syndication. It's sort of a judgment call. Mauricio and I have decided we think five is a pretty safe number. Just generally, if you go above five, it starts to look more like people are going to be passive. In terms of the duties, first of all, you want to make sure that there's no one person calling all the shots, making all the management decisions, taking a fee especially for it, and then everybody else just has no idea what they're doing. Everybody should be somewhat knowledgeable if they're going to actually be a partner, because that's what a JV is. It's a partnership of, let's say, five people that they're all contributing in some way. I've had clients ask me to tell them, like, what's the bare minimum people have to do so I don't get in trouble with the SEC? And of course, that's a scary question for the lawyer to answer, because I'm like, it depends. It depends on the SEC makes most of its determinations on what we call a facts and circumstances analysis. And that means you've got to have more good facts than bad facts that matter to the person who's actually making the determination, which is a human being. And I don't know who that human being is going to be. So if there was a hard and fast rule, I would love to be able to tell you it's no more than five, it's this, this, and this duty. And then it would be easy. It's not as easy. But so some guidance is we want to give people voting rights, for example. So if you and I and two other people are in this deal, we should all be voting. And the vote shouldn't be, well, I'm going to always have 90% because I'm the one actually doing all the work anyway, but here's 2% because you gave me $5 million. That's not going to work. You've got to think of it, look at it through the eyes of a SEC investigator or a regulator. Would you, with a straight face, be able to tell them, no, I'm actively involved in this deal, and then show them what you did to be actively involved? If you're an investigator or a regulator, would you buy that? So you got to think about it in terms of we're dealing with humans that are making a determination. Some other things to consider, is there a carried interest? Is there a split that varies between, that's not just ownership split? Like if we own 25% among four of us or something like that versus 80-20 with a 2% management fee. Well, that starts to look like a syndication if you do it that way. It's the operating agreement. Does the operating agreement vest most of the control in a single manager, even if you split it up right? So it's really all these things combined. I would say, make sure everybody's got a meaningful vote. Make sure everybody knows what the heck they're voting on and why would they have a vote. Make sure that there's some oversight of the people putting in the money and not just all vested in one single manager.
So in the initial joint venture agreement, a lot of times the duties and things that people are going to be doing is written right into the document. Wanted to ask you real quickly, if people don't perform on those duties, what are the consequences? Like a lot of you can kick them out, but in what kind of situation would that make sense if they're not performing?
It really, that all should be outlined in the operating agreement ahead of time. Because once, if I own 25% of an LLC, that's my personal property. You don't get to just take that away from me unless we already have an agreement of how you can take that away from me. So if you fire somebody, You can stop paying them their salary that they were supposed to be earning, but you can't take away their personal property unless there's an agreement that says, hey, I can get back these 25% if you fail to show up and do these things. But I would define it upfront in the agreement of what's going to trigger you getting kicked out. And what does that look like? And what is that valued at, if anything? You know, there's a lot that goes into that. It's a pretty complicated agreement.
Okay, cool.
It should be.
I've heard this, and there's a little bit of misconception. We probably won't spend too much time on this, but I've heard in the industry, I haven't seen it done yet, but I have heard rumblings of this particular concept where if you have a 506B, it can't invest into a 506C. But prior to the show, you mentioned if there's a $5 million threshold of assets that are owned by that particular fund or company, it can then invest into a 506C. What is the rule? What have you heard?
So the rule, what we're looking at is what's the definition of an accredited investor is what it boils down to. So for an entity to be considered an accredited investor, one of two things has to happen. One is all the members themselves have to be accredited. So there's a look through, or the entity itself has to have $5 million in assets not acquired for purposes of making this investment. So you can't just go raise $5 million and go, we made it, we're accredited. It doesn't matter if everybody in it is not accredited. So the entity itself had to already have $5 million in net worth. Now, I think the question that where this came up and where you might have heard it is, what about the case where it's a fund or a fund-to-fund situation where there's assets now in there that weren't generated in exchange for specifically for this one asset? And there's not a lot of case law on this, but what we've determined is we think that would be enough to where it's got the $5 million in assets. So we think it would make the determination. That is a little bit unsettled, but the reality is it, as long as you're not just saying, hey, everybody come into my fund who's not accredited, we'll raise $5 million to get around this rule. There's no getting around the rules. It's we're going to comply. And how are we going to comply? One of the ways is it's got $5 million in assets and then we didn't raise it just for that deal.
Okay, great. That's amazing clarification. Let's dive into regulation crowd funds. Because you mentioned that you and Mauricio and your firm, I think it's Premier Law Group, you guys do a little bit of this stuff. I think there's a little bit of confusion around what CF is. I used to think it was kind of like Reg A, but then I realized that it's like only a $5 million. It's actually a lot smaller and easier, but kind of expensive capital raise. However, I think the main thing, I'll let you kind of, I don't want to get to steal all the thunder. What is crowdfund from your perspective? When does it make sense to use it?
So let me first distinguish that crowdfunding has a little bit of confusion just because there's like the crowdfunding that people started having where they're giving away like swag to generate in startups. This is not that. This is regulation crowdfunding, which is an SEC regulation. And what it is it's almost like a mini IPO, but not to the level of a Reg A plus. So you're right. The maximum raise in any given year is $5 million. The benefit of Reg CF over, let's say, Reg D is that you get to advertise on a platform, though, and that is really monitored and regulated, right? You get to advertise and you also get to take non-accredited investors. The big difference over Reg CF over Reg D is that you actually have to get the SEC involved. The SEC, there's an application, it's called a Form C. The SEC has to bless it. You get on a platform or a portal and that's a broker dealer. That's something that you've got to get one that the SEC has already pre-approved. And then you go through this whole process. Now you're starting to understand why it might be a little bit more expensive and why it might be a little bit more time consuming because we're dealing with a governmental body now and not just here's your docs, we're under an exemption like Reg D. There are some other limitations. You're limited in how much of a non-accredited investor's net worth or income you're allowed to take as an investment. That's also true in Reg A+. It is a simpler process than Reg A+, though. So Reg A+ is a little bit more akin to an IPO. So it's like almost like a hybrid between the two. The Form C itself is not super complicated. It's really just a matter of, are we going to have to go back and forth with the SEC and also doing your diligence and choosing the platform where this is going to live? Do you need help marketing this? Or are you an influencer already and you just need a place to house all this and you want the cheapest possible option? So there's just a lot of things to consider that you don't have to consider in a Reg D offering, but you do get that benefit of being able to go after both non-accredited and accredited and still be able to advertise. So that's the high level differences. I think most of your listeners probably understand what Reg D is. So of course, the idea that you can advertise and take non-accredited all at the same time is nice. We do have some clients that because it takes a little longer to get a Reg CF off the ground, which is hard when you're talking about a specific property. You've got usually a 45-day close, 60-day close, maybe some extensions. They'll start with a Reg D and then they'll roll it over into a Reg CF when that's ready. So that's something that people will do sometimes as well. So they can kind of complement, especially if you need to raise more than $5 million.
Yeah, I've heard of people doing it simultaneously, like a Reg D and then also a CF so they can advertise. Let me clarify, Regulation D, Exemption 506C. So you're allowed to advertise there, but now you can get non-accredited investors in your CF. So here's another question I'm very curious about, because you mentioned that you have to do advertising on the platform, but I've seen some people doing Facebook ads and stuff like this. Are they doing anything wrong there, or is that allowed?
Not necessarily. It could be allowed. You're getting pre-approval from the SEC, though. You can't just go do whatever. You're letting the SEC know what you're going to do. They're going to say, okay, that's fine. And then you're going to do it. So most of it's going to live on the portal. Most of the Facebook ads you see, though, are probably directing people to a portal. You can say some things in there and the SEC's already blessed if they're doing it right. Of course, they're not all my clients, so I don't know. But if they're doing it right, the things that they're saying in their ads are already approved in some way, and then they're directing traffic to the portal. That's okay. Likely what's happening.
Cool. Let me ask you about fund of funds. What is a fund of funds? Let me have you answer that before I dig into a little bit of a deeper nuance that I'm curious about.
Yeah, this has been such a hot topic lately. I love it. So a fund of funds is really when you're raising capital to then go be a passive investor in other operators' deals. That's what it boils down to. So a fund of funds, you're raising money for deals that you're not operating yourself. You're investing them as a passive in other operators' deals.
Okay, so when can it be dangerous where you start to look like you're a money manager, or that you should be having a license? Because I've heard that, like, if you have a fund that's investing into a bunch of different people's funds, then you're starting to act like a broker dealer.
Not necessarily a broker dealer. We want to keep you out of that. And I can explain the difference. So the first thing we talk about is you don't want to look like an investment advisor. Otherwise, you need to either be registered as an investment advisor, or you need to fall under some exemption. And that's a state level exemption. So it depends on which state you're in. And what that limits is who your investors are allowed to be. So in some states, if you do a fund of funds, in order to stay out of being considered an investment advisor or be exempt from having to be licensed, you can only bring in accredited investors. In some states, it's qualified purchasers. It could be up to $5 million in net worth in some states. In some states, it's like, don't do it with more than 5 funds in a year and we're good. So Florida, you can imagine Florida, you can do anything you want. That's the first thing. The broker dealer part, what you have to think about is you have to structure the fund of funds so that you're actually making your money. If you're raising a fund of funds, you should be making your money at the fund of funds level. If you're going to charge fees, you're charging your investors fees. If you're going to take a promote, you're taking it at the fund of funds level, because you're providing so much value to your investors by vetting all these operators, by giving them diversification within the same fund, whatever it is. Maybe you're negotiating for higher returns because you're a bigger check writer. You're providing value to your investors. You are not getting paid by the operators you're investing in, because then you'd be getting paid like a broker dealer for raising money. So if you're a legitimate fund of funds, you're providing value at the fund level, your investors are happy to take a split with you, just like with a syndication. And the operators, while they might give the whole entire fund a better return, because again, you might be a bigger check writer or something like that, they're not paying you because you raised money. That's the distinction of not being considered a broker dealer that I think some people forget. I actually think, and Mauricio and I have talked about this, we think it's a little bit even safer if a fund of funds invests in multiple operators, because then it's less like you're just out raising money for a single operator for a fee. We don't want to look like a disguised commission. But as long as you are doing the diligence, as long as you're really creating value and you can show where you've created that value, then you're earning your fee at the fund level. It doesn't look like you're a broker dealer getting paid a disguised commission from the syndicator. And that's the delicate balance that we really drive home to our clients is, what are you doing? What are you doing to add value? Tell me what you're doing.
Okay, cool. I've heard syndication attorneys say that the whole purpose of a fund is for diversification. And yet I see some really big operators that are raising a lot of capital from co-GPs, and they're doing fund of funds, telling them set up a fund and then you can raise capital for a deal, which doesn't sound like diversification for me. What is your take on, can you do a fund of funds if that fund is only raising for one particular deal?
If you would have asked me this 6 months ago, I'd have been like, no, I hire another lawyer. We're not doing it. Mauricio and I got together and we really had a heart-to-heart, like, all right, how can we start to feel safe telling our clients that they can do this? And it boils down to, yes, it is possible to go out and be a fund of funds and then end up only investing in one single operator. But you really have to keep good records and really do diligence and do the work to add the value. You cannot just be like, all right, I'm going to raise this much money and I'm going to wind up getting what would equate to, let's say, a 2% fee for raising money. It can't be a direct line of, I raise money, I end up getting 2% for you, but I'm taking it out of my investor's cut. And you should be able to show why it makes sense for your investors to invest in your fund of funds versus going direct into the deal. Let's say you're not getting a better return for them. You're getting the exact same return as everybody else going in as this LP. Well, what other value as an investor do I get? Could I not have invested otherwise because maybe I can't meet the minimums? Could I not have invested otherwise? Obviously, I didn't know about the deal. I didn't have to do the diligence, but why wouldn't I just go direct into that deal if I'm going to get a better return rather than pay you? You better show me how you provided value so that the investors, it makes sense for them to pay you. But if you can show all that value, then I can get comfortable with it being a single operator. The timing is also something that I would want to look at too. Like, are you setting this up just to invest in this deal? Again, facts and circumstances. We need more good facts than bad facts here. So if we have more good facts, then we can get comfortable with it. And you know, you just have to follow the directions that we're giving you to keep you safe.
Okay, let's talk about securities law violations. Can you really go to jail, or is it more like you'll get a slap on the wrist and something like, hey, you're not allowed to raise capital for the next 10 years? So what are some of the consequences that in reality actually happen? If you're not committing fraud, are you really going to go to jail, or what exactly happens when you condition the market, for example, or do something that violates law?
The reality is you're probably not going to go to jail if you're not actively defrauding people. A Ponzi scheme, you could go to jail. Your Bernie Madoff or some others you might have heard about in the news, you could go to jail for active fraud and an ongoing fraud. Are you going to go to jail for something you posted on Facebook, you know, where it was sort of mistakenly conditioning the market when you didn't mean to do that? Probably not jail. But again, I go back to this facts and circumstances. You don't want to walk the line too much. You know, what we do, so Mauricio and I, what we do is we set up guardrails for our clients. And we're asking you to stay within these guardrails. You can kind of bump up against them if you're comfortable with it. That's a business decision you can make. If you're going outside the guardrails, we might have to make the decision that we just can't represent you. But when you're outside these guardrails, either way, you have to think, if an SEC investigator or regulator is looking at this, what if you get the person who thinks that they're going to just make their career on you and they're going to just make an example out of you? Well, even if you don't end up in jail, you've got to deal with this. And it could shut your whole business down, even if it's a slap on the wrist, like, well, you shouldn't have done that. Don't do it again. Okay. Well, how much time and money did it take you to deal with that? It's like an audit. You might not go to jail for that, but it's time and money. But beyond that, it's very possible that if you've been knowingly or should have known that you're violating securities laws over and over and over across multiple deals for various things, you could very well be banned from raising money. And you could be put in that sort of bad actor category and be banned from raising money, or even be banned from being on a management team who's raising money. I'd love to be able to say, if you do this, then for sure you're never going to raise money. If you do this, then for sure you're going to get a fine of this much money. It's not quite that simple. And that's why we're like, just play by the rules. And you don't have to worry about it. Okay, or at least stay within the guardrails.
Awesome. Good stuff. All right. Let's dive into the lightning round. My first question to you is, what's the best vacation you've ever taken?
I should say Belize, since we just bought a boutique hotel in Belize, and that's up there, although it wasn't technically a vacation. And I have to say, the Europe trip I took with my daughter, we went this summer and we went last summer. I'm even going to say last summer, even though we both got COVID on that trip, we still had the time of our lives. We just got to pivot and we holed up and we quarantined in this beautiful hotel suite on the 10th and absolutely just loved it. That was the vacation of a lifetime. I got quality time with my daughter. And even as, you know, with COVID, right, you're still quarantined even though you feel better. So we're just like stuck in the same room, hanging out, watching Disney and hanging out. It was awesome.
Hilarious. Awesome. Favorite book of any kind?
I'm going to have to say Who Not How. That is one of my life-changing books.
How much of your success do you attribute to mindset?
90%.
How long do you want to live?
This is going to sound crazy. 110.
That doesn't sound crazy. I want to live to 121. I had somebody come on. I've had a couple of people say they want to live forever. Some people said 150. And there's a lot of science that can help you do that now.
Yeah. I mean, if I could be a vampire, I would. I would have chosen to do it before I had these lines. But be a vampire and live forever, I could manage that.
What does conscious wealth mean to you?
This is one of my favorite topics, Ruben. Conscious wealth means to me is intentionally curating your experiences and your life and creating wealth that is not just money, but a life that you get to where you get to enjoy that wealth. So it's all the pillars. It's your financial success, yes, but it's your health, it's your relationships, it's whatever spirituality is meaningful for you. It's like all the things intentionally curated for your own perfect, extraordinary life.
Cool. I'm looking forward to diving deeper into that kind of concept on your Bubbles with Bethany event.
I can't wait. That's going to be fun.
A short answer on this, best way to raise capital from your perspective.
Develop amazing, deep relationships and then go to your friends now and ask them, do you want part of this opportunity? You're not asking them for money. You're offering them an opportunity. Make sure that they understand that. Make sure you understand and believe that.
Can you tell me about a moment that changed the trajectory of your life?
When I actually first spent money on myself for personal development, for my first mastermind, it paid for itself exponentially. And that really changed the trajectory of my life.
Huge proponent of personal development. Okay, what do you love best about being a syndication attorney?
I get really geeked out about helping people create conscious wealth and therefore scale their real estate businesses. And in my opinion, the best way to do that is OPM.
Awesome. How about this? What do you love? You mentioned that you're writing a book and one of your favorite hobbies is writing and being an author. What do you love best about that?
It allows me to explore my creative mind, which you don't always get to do as a lawyer. I think it helps me keep my creativity sharp for when I'm strategizing with my clients. And it's sort of one of those, I have a hard time resting and it feels like a productive hobby to me. Like I'm producing something while I'm having fun.
When do you think that your book is going to be done?
In the next 2 weeks, actually. I'm almost done.
Hopefully it'll be out by the time this gets released. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
100%.
How so?
I would not consider myself a religious person, which I should be careful in this space saying that. But once I started embracing that there's sort of more than just me, whatever that is, I don't really have a word for it. It's not the dogma of it. It's once I realized that I had a connection to something and that there was my higher self, universe, whatever you want to call it, I felt like I was more taken care of. And therefore there's this comfort in that of knowing that I have everything I need to be successful and it's just all taken care of. I just need to do the work.
Beautiful. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
Near-death experience, I don't think so. Experienced a miracle. It's gonna sound trite, but my daughter, I decided that I wanted to have a baby. I had a baby right then and it was like, my friend, it was like, you had like drive-through baby. Like I decided I wanted her. I got pregnant immediately and I'm so blessed for that. So that for people who haven't, I recognize. And I guess that is the miracle. She's healthy. So. She's perfect. I'm so blessed for that. Yeah.
Life itself is a miracle as far as I'm concerned. What impact would you like to leave in the world?
I've said this before. Part of what drives me is that my daughter and other people are watching, but mostly my daughter and young girls are watching me. And I want to do epic shit because I want them to see me doing that, not because I want them to be impressed by me or in awe of me, but because I want them to look at me and just go, yeah, that's what women do.
I love that. Okay, cool. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to my friends at Legacy Acquisitions and our sponsors, the Family Office Club and Invest Next. Bethany, how does the audience get a hold of you?
I think the best way is team, T-E-A-M, at PLGLP.com. And of course, subscribe to my lives, which is BethanyLaflamme.com/live or bubbles. Depending, and always happy to have a follow on Instagram, Bethany_LaFlamme.
Any particular videos that, like, what's your most popular video? Or what do you think is like the greatest learning lesson in some of the videos that you've done?
I think one of the most popular ones that I have is on should you form a fund? And that's on my YouTube channel. And I think another one was on creating business plans that are compliant with the SEC. Although one of my most liked videos, of course, on YouTube is one I did with Britt Arneson when we did a tour of our Belize hotel. So of course, we've got a beautiful hotel and we've got Britt Arneson on there. And that's probably my most liked video on YouTube.
Awesome. Not only are you a syndication attorney, but you're also an investor. I love that. Yeah. All right. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser or syndicator as they scale on their journey?
Absolutely. Figure out what you are amazing at. Figure out what lights you up. That is your lane. Stay in it. For everything else, there's OPE.
Woo. All right. This has been a lot of fun, Bethany. I really appreciate you coming on and for our Raising Money Masterclass. So I look forward to having you back for future events. Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you. So much fun. Appreciate it.